Hi, my name is Mike Ginn. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on safety and security in web-based software. More and more, applications being used by companies in the RM industry are based online or in the cloud. Cloud-based software presents a different set of safety and security issues than traditional hosted software, and we're fortunate to have a panel of IT experts to share their insights into how companies can secure the web-based software they are using. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Interpros. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the RM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the RM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use. It is a great resource of news and information to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Keith Barthold is the CEO of DKB Innovative. Keith is a proven leader focused on driving business goals, including cybersecurity, compliance, operational efficiency, revenue growth, and enhanced profitability. While establishing DKB Innovative, Keith enjoyed a 10-plus year career at Faro Systems, Dell Services, with a number of notable accomplishments, including growing a $20 million application portfolio and leading delivery for Tenet Healthcare's hospital EMR and patient management applications. Kevin Epstein is a professionally certified AWS Solutions Architect, DevOps Engineer, Developer, and SysOps Admin at Onica. He spends his days obsessing over designing and deploying the most resilient, performant, secure, and cost-effective infrastructures for customers in the AWS cloud. Kevin also leads the Los Angeles AWS Users Meetup Group with 2,000-plus members. Matt Kiefer is the Chief Officer for Information Development and Compliance for the Preferred Group of Tampa. He is a past president and current vice president, again, of the an education chair of the Florida Collectors Association. He served on the board of the National Healthcare Collectors Association and was a member of the HFMA and MGMA, and is also an ACA scholar and fellow. He has been in healthcare and collection since 2001. Matt enjoys shooting, MMA, CrossFit, and politics. He is not known for being politically correct, he says. Jeremy Mapes is founder and president of Mapes Consulting, which is one of the very few vendors previously endorsed by ACA International as a preferred vendor and senior executive to Agent Z LLC. Jeremy has more than 24 years in the RM industry and has successfully headed operations and technology for companies from large to small, and has consulted to and supported well over 100 collection agencies and creditors on technology, automation, telephony, operations, and information security management, as well as consulting directly to multiple receivable software vendors. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everyone to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please type it into the question tab or tap the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel and submit. The webinar today is in audio only event. There is no video component or presentation component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screens, you're not missing anything. A recording of this event will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. And with that, let's start our discussion. So let's sort of set the table first and talk about what should a collection agency maintain as the core safety and security essentials when using web-based software? And Jeremy, I'd like you to start.
Well, it's great to be here today, and I appreciate being here and inviting me, Mike, and glad to speak to everybody out there. As far as the first question, I think every agency this day is dealing with having some type of construct in their company where they're dealing with compliance. I rarely see, and they're not going to last long if an agency out there doesn't have some type of internal compliance structure. And I'm hoping that most out there are adopting from one group or another some set of compliance tools and information management system. When we say system, some set of procedures or somebody that or say your ISO 27001. Everybody's dealing pretty much with PCI if you've got credit cards. So when you're looking at safety and security with web-based software, there's a lot of good instruction out there on what the level of scope should be for it. So when we're talking about collection agencies and maintaining safety and security with their web-based software, the first thing you have to look at is, what is that software? Are we talking about the collection system software where they're going to be housing their data and the level of risk that's involved with that, where we're talking about simply, say, a skip trace vendor where we're pulling data down through, which might open up a hole or potential risk to bring inside the environment, such as allowing web-based access to staff or collection group. So the first thing you need to do is figure out how you're going to scope that out and how much risk is involved with that potential software.
I guess I could follow that up, and this is Kevin Epstein from Onica. You know, particularly as we see various vendors moving to the cloud and into web-based type of services and software, a lot changes in terms of how we secure the environment. But to a large degree, the things that we were doing when we were talking to our vendors in the past remain the same. So as we're doing vendor assessments, we want to make sure that they carry the various attestations, that they're being audited regularly. If there are any significant findings, do they have a disclosure policy that they can do that safely with you? So in many ways, not a lot changes for you just because we're dealing with customers or providers that are on the web. But the technical challenges of how do we safeguard our environments, that will change. And so we talk about things like TLS encryption for web technologies and things like that. It might be also encryption at the disk levels. I think also just generally speaking is beyond sort of vendor selection. Again, really just understanding that not a whole lot changes. And I think from a perspective of operations, we had these conversations with our vendors long before the web was a thing. They still had to have their attestations. They still had to prove that they were operating the data center in a responsible manner. So we should not look at the cloud or web technologies as being a massive disruptor in the way we view our vendors.
And this is Jeremy. I apologize. I am back. I somehow got disconnected there for a moment.
No worries. Thanks. So, Kevin, just to follow up on what you were saying, if you're saying that we shouldn't be viewed as a massive disruptor, does that mean it's a minimal disruptor, or do you mean sort of not necessarily a disruptor at all?
Well, the term disruption gets used quite liberally these days. And I think, I think business as usual is pretty much what's happening. The web technologies means we can interact much more quickly and closely with our partners. And from that perspective, it is sort of disruptive because the speed of business is increasing and the momentum is increasing. But the fundamentals of screening out and selecting good, solid, trustworthy partners has not changed. Principles of governance haven't really changed that much. It's really the technical side of implementation to meet governance that's changing.
Thanks. Keith, let me take what Kevin was saying and present you with a question. Do you agree that the fundamentals of how you select vendors, be it whether they're offering a hosted solution or a cloud or web-based solution, is really the same? Nothing's really changed there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is really finding good vendor relationships, good partner relationships that put cybersecurity front and center. I mean, there are way too many companies out there that really think of compliance and security as an afterthought. They're focused on the solution and they're focused on providing end results for their clients, but they kind of put security to the side until it is important. And so when you have a software company that really leads with security and puts that front and center throughout their development cycles and make sure that they build on a platform of compliance and then operate with a culture of compliance, then really from the recipient's view of that services, there should be a real sigh of relief knowing that now I'm transferring some of that liability and sharing some of that responsibility especially in the ARM industry where you've got so much data to deal with and so many transactions that are sensitive to your clients and the people you're doing collections from, right? But for a software company that leads with security to take on that risk and share that responsibility, that's a good thing, because let's face it, if that is their specialty and that's their expertise, like it is for Interpros, they're going to embrace it, and then they're going to make the clients that they're serving stronger and put them in a better security position.
So how do you then make sure that, you know, a vendor has put security first and isn't necessarily treating it as an afterthought?
Well, I think one of the ways you can do that, and I mean, I can answer for our position and from the context that I come into, and in that we're doing security programs, compliance programs, overall managed security for our clients that are selecting that software. And I think the key is to ask a lot of questions. When it comes to evaluating whether you're going to put software in-house or whether you're going to have it on the cloud, if you're going to have it in-house, that software is only as secure as your own infrastructure and the compliance program that you have. Whereas when you're selecting it from a vendor that's hosting it on the cloud, then it's a matter of trusting what they have in place. And so to get there, you have to ask a lot of questions, and you start asking security questions from day one. As important as the functionality of the software itself, is it going to meet your business needs? But also, is it going to put me in a position that's going to be a risk to the business and the clients we serve, or is it going to close gaps and enhance our security profile to where, as a collections professional, I'm actually in a better position because I'm more secure now after adopting this cloud-based software.
And this is Jeremy.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, if I could add to that, there's really one of three ways that and depending on level of risk, if it's a high risk, like it's going to be a remote collection software, there's three ways you're going to evaluate that risk. Either you're going to audit yourself if you have the means and the knowledge to do so and what you're looking for. You're going to hire a third party to audit it, to come in and evaluate it. In most cases, a lot of the software vendors out there that are doing, if they have a high level of risk, such as holding your data, they're usually going to have already undertook some type of information security management system program. When I got cut off, I was talking about such as ISO 27001 or what used to be SAS 70 SAA or SAE. And have a list of compliances and pieces out there that they've certified to a third party. And that's an important thing, that they didn't just certify themselves, but they've certified to some third party that they can give you that list of how they met compliance requirements, so that way you don't have to spend your money to do the due diligence. And most people I find a lot of the companies out there are ready to meet that, because I get those questions all the time from larger potential clients. So that would be one of the ways that you would look to see how they're meeting that.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to pause the discussion just for a couple of minutes and introduce Aaron Ryder from Interpro to say a few words. Aaron?
Thanks, Mike. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Interpro is really excited to sponsor this webinar topic because it represents a subject we take very seriously. Interpro's flagship product is a web-based debt recovery platform called ACE. Some of you may know it as WebAR before we rebranded it last year. We have worked diligently to educate the market for the last 10 years on the safety, security, and significant cost savings to collection agencies or departments that take advantage of cloud computing through software like ours. And it is our core belief as a service provider to our customers that it is our responsibility to take the burdens of data security, infrastructure compliance, data backups, document storage and backups off their backs so they can concentrate on their business and put their investments into things that they, well, that they want to invest in. So by using the AWS cloud infrastructure, we're making those investments in time and money for them, and they inherit all that compliance and security. So hopefully, by listening to today's panel of experts, and thank you all for joining us today, we'll help everyone on the call understand how safe and convenient web computing has become compared to traditional on-premises solutions. And if you'd like any additional information on InterPros, we're invite you to visit our website at interpros.com. That's interprose.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Aaron, and thanks again to InterPros for sponsoring today's webinar. Now let's resume our discussion. Jeremy, I wanted to circle back on something that Keith was talking about with in terms of asking a lot of questions, you know, especially as they relate to security questions, and wanted to see if you had any questions or any examples of what types of questions that that companies should be asking, especially as it pertains to this topic.
Sure. And one thing that I want to mention, when we talk about information security, everybody's always thinking about the security part, that if somebody's going to break in and get into your data. But I'd like for this discussion everybody to think about, and I always call it the three-tier structure, the CIA. When we talk about information security, we need to think about three things, not just one. We need to think about confidentiality, which everybody's thinking about today and why a lot of people showed up for this conference. But also the especially when we're talking about a hosted platform, the integrity and the availability. So the CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Because if you lose any of those three things, then you're compromised in one way or another as far as how you can get to the data. Is the data any good? And then is somebody breaking in and getting a hold of the data? So when we frame that and we look at some of the questions we need to be asking, and besides just seeing if they've been through a list of questions already with somebody that's validated them, we need to be thinking about, okay, so how are we guarded? How are we connecting? How are you going to assure us that if for some reason your primary, do you have a backup? You know, what's the business continuity plan? If your systems go down, if your site's compromised, you have a secondary site. How does that come up? How does that affect us? Is there a backup IP address? Those type of connectivity issues. And then if as far as data integrity, what's the assurance level of that? Are you RAID 5 on your systems? So there's a whole host of questions, probably too many questions to ask to the vendor when it has to do with a critical vendor. And we could even provide a list later on as far as what some of those main items are to look for. But the big things are is thinking about how they're going to keep the confidentiality between you and them and on their site, how they're going to keep from the data, keep the integrity of the data, how they're not going to mess that up, or if it gets messed up, how are they going to be able to bring it back, and the availability of the data, how they're going to keep their lights on and their systems running. To give a simple example of availability, one of the large vendors out there, I believe it was eBay at the time, they had paid over, and this is not a surprise, but they paid quite a bit of money to have a $1 million guarantee from Hitachi that their systems would never go down. And so Hitachi guaranteed them for every hour that their systems were down, that they would have to pay them $1 million for the loss of time. And you would think, who would want to sign off on that? Of course, I'm sure they're paying the money to compensate for it, but to have that level of integrity, what kind of hardware will guarantee that you're never going to go down, that if you go down, that somebody's going to pay you $1 million? That's quite a bit. And something more than we're going to ask for is such as a collection agency. But, you know, what levels, what background infrastructure, what provides that to guarantee that there's not going to be something that's going to take that down and take you offline? Like I said, afterwards, if we want to, I can provide locations to people of places to look of preset questions, but the list can be rather lengthy. And I always say, center around that CIA and you're on your way to the right place to get to.
Good information. Thanks, Jeremy. Kevin, I wanted to ask you, in what areas do you see the greatest security risk? Sort of following up on what Jim was just talking about, the greatest security risk related to using web-based software.
So I think, we often see in the news disclosure of breach and data leakage and data loss, and it usually makes the news. Quite often people think that it's some fantastic thing happened, and that's usually not the case. What really is happening is that some very fundamental stuff is getting missed. I like to call it the basic block and tackle of security. Do we have SSL enabled? These are not tough technologies anymore. The cloud and technology in general has moved forward enough that this is easy to implement, but quite often overlooked. Similarly, when you see data loss coming out of, let's say, a service like Amazon's S3, what's actually happened is someone just didn't pay attention to the permissions on that service and make sure that only the correct services and people can actually get to that data. So there's a lot of challenges in just doing basic block and tackle. We don't have to do super sleuth type of security technologies to be secure. We do have to do things like encryption, both across the wire, so using TLS encryption. And this is something actually that you do need to pay attention to. It's no longer acceptable to have just simple SSL certificates and encryption on web-based applications. You do need to make sure that your partners are working with TLS 1.2, which is the most current and accepted version of SSL encryption across the wire. But beyond that, making sure that data that's stored on a server is stored in encrypted fashion, that the keys for those encryption are out of the hands of developers, out of the hands of operators, because if the keys are available to anyone, the encryption is very nearly worthless. So, following that with automation, making sure that the system can get the data for you on your behalf, but not a person. We want to take the responsibility of direct access and data out of a human's hands and make sure that the web application is getting that data for us and transmitting it securely across the web over a TLS 1.2 connection. Then just generally understanding that defense comes from depth. So you can't say, well, I have encryption, therefore I'm secure. We have to secure at multiple layers. We have to make sure that our data centers are secure. And in a cloud world, that's usually your provider. So someone like Amazon Web Services. And they have attestations that they can show that their external audits have occurred and that they're compliant. Your developers need to write good, secure code. You have to have good segregation of duty amongst all of your team members so that the right people have the right access to data. It's continual policing of your own policies, continual policing of your partner's policies to make sure that everyone's doing the right things. And again, this is mostly the basic block and tackle of security, making sure that everyone understands in this world, everyone has a security role to play, whether you're the developer, whether you're the customer, whether you're a business analyst, everyone actually does have to have an eye to security. It's no longer acceptable to say, well, we have an InfoSec team and they'll do security. That doesn't work in today's world.
Very thorough. Thank you, Kevin. We had a question came in that's sort of on this topic, so I wanted to depart from the list of discussion topics we have and ask it, and it's kind of healthcare related. So Matt Kiefer, if you're there, I'd love to get your input on this. What do you recommend to ensure that PII is encrypted end-to-end during transmission, receipt, and while being stored?
Well, I'm aware that there's several programs out there that will encrypt it, but you definitely need to use, SFTP and make sure you're sending it securely from point to point, because it can be, intercepted anywhere along the way. But actually, Jeremy might be more suited to take this question as far as the encryption methods and types.
I appreciate that, Matt. There's actually a bevy of them, because you have SFTP, FTPS, and that's for file transfer. As was said before, TLS, when you've got a web connection coming through, And this is something that's always changing too. So what may be right today, just like SSL used to be just fine, those things change and we need to stay current on what those are, which I think brings up a good point, is that security is not a one-time event. So just because you find that a vendor you have today has all the I's dotted and the T's crossed and they're in good shape and they've got a current, say, ISO 27001 certification, you need to make sure that you are at least at the minimum annually checking your critical vendors, the ones where you're passing critical information, to make sure that they're staying current as well on what those security measures are. Usually with your web base, whether it's hosted or it's an application that's being housed in the web, companies that have critical information, they're going to be meeting a checklist and those will come along with it. But part of staying current with what you need to use is to stay current with groups. I think if I'm an agency, I need to assign, or a creditor even. If I don't have if I'm a little bitty shop and I can't afford a standalone compliance officer, I need to have somebody in my shop or somebody third party that I can always, just like Matt did, refer to that they can refer to and find out what the latest is. And based on the type of application, that'll dictate it. Because, for instance, if we're doing a hosted environment and they may be hosting a collection software application on their site, maybe it's not external to the web, but basically they've taken your software, put it on, housed it somewhere, and now you've got to connect to wherever that location is. You'll be coming over what's normally a VPN type tunnel if it's not web accessible. When I say web accessible, something that you can log into through a website. And so that VPN tunnel will have certain constraints. We also have to consider that if we have any home workers or if we have anybody that's going to be remotely connecting in from outside. One of the biggest risks out there, other than I think one of the major risks, is somebody inside your office or the office of where the data is stored getting and using that information maliciously. One of the second most ways for information to be compromised is that you're at a remote site, and such as, let's say you're at a vacation spot and you're logging into your system or your company. And a lot of these spots now, especially high profile locations, major places like hotels and so forth, I don't see people seen it on TV. They've got it now where people are out there and they're pretending to be the Wi-Fi, like the pool Wi-Fi or the internal hotel's location Wi-Fi. And you can't tell them, in a lot of cases, you can't tell the house Wi-Fi from being the malicious access Wi-Fi. So it's good to, if you've got any people working remotely, to have them invest. It's very low cost. There's lots of different applications out there like Nord, N-O-R-D, VPN. They're very low cost. I think 3 years is something like $20 or $30 for a VPN application, so that whatever site you're at, you're encrypting that connection out to a server and getting past those local Wi-Fi that might be have been corrupted or malicious or they're being ghosted, so that way you know that you're bypassing anybody that might do a man-in-the-middle attack or might be able to gain access to what's on even your cell phone, if not your laptop.
Yeah, and actually, Jeremy, you bring up a really good point, is that, it's not really assuming if someone's remote, but generally assuming that everyone is remote. If you think about how people go about business today, they're on the road, connecting from mobile devices, they may be at a Starbucks, they could be could be anywhere. And so the approach has to be assume that people are remote, assume that we're securing for the worst possible scenario. And using tools and technologies like VPN are very effective ways to improve security. But it's also, in our experience, not realistic to ask everyone to do that. In principle, it's not a difficult task to do, but in many cases, people won't do it anyway. And so I think that's just another layer in that defense in depth sort of mantra, is make sure that you have end-to-end encryption using TLS technologies. Make sure that you can, if you've got it, use a VPN, and always assume that people are connecting over insecure methods.
Yeah, this is Keith. I'd also like to speak to that just as we talk about encryption, the data at rest as well. If you're working with PHI or PII, one of the difficult things to achieve is to have an awareness of where that data is. Certainly, you know, as you use a web-based app and collection software like Interpros, it's easier to have that identification of where it's at, since it's not sitting in-house and could, you know, be spread out across multiple servers and locations and networks. You really get to, by using a web-based app, you get to narrow your focus on security and narrow where that data is and how you protect it. But beyond that, what we find is that inevitably organizations are going to have that PHI just spread throughout their system. We've done a lot of audits at hospitals where we ask, where is the PHI located? We'll say, okay, it's on our cloud-based app. It's here. But then inevitably you find spreadsheets and you find documents and just a massive amount of data that has protected information on it. Very simple solution. Use BitLocker. BitLocker encryption for hard drive encryption. Now, this is not for data in transit. This is for data at rest. But use an approach like making sure that you have BitLocker encryption for hard drive encryption on all of your company's machines. That's all the servers where there's going to be data at rest, all the workstations and laptops, because when a laptop disappears out of someone's car is not the time when you want to start wondering, did they have PHI on that? Do I need to report this to my client? Is this a breach that's going to go to OCR and Health and Human Services? What kind of fines? You don't want to have that kind of night. Much better to be able to go back and look at your report and go, it had encryption on it and we checked it and we verified it was implemented then. We've got the reports that show it does. And then at that point, it's under safe harbor. It's encrypted. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to report it.
This is Jeremy. That's a good point you bring up about locking the data at rest. I don't know how many people out there remember, this goes back probably 10 years. I'm not going to try to date myself on how long I've been in this industry, which is much longer than that. But there was a collection agency in Indiana, and I don't know how secure they were on their outside information, their laptops, but they had an incident where the company got broken into and the servers got stolen. And they were collecting for healthcare organizations. It was after HIPAA had been come into practice. And so they had to go tell all their clients, because they didn't have storage at rest, that yes, their servers, somebody broke in their office and took their servers, and that data was at risk because they had no type of encryption on those servers. Or if they'd had something like BitLocker or some other security encryption tool to take care of that, it wouldn't have been a big deal. They wouldn't have had to go tell their clients that happened.
Yeah. I just want to add one thing too. Especially if you have a software that allows client access, you're going to want to make sure, subject to HIPAA and the minimum necessary rule, that they only have access to their data. It's not an all access pass, and that they're not able to write on your system or write data on your system. They're only able to read it. And, that's something we have with our software in place. And then the restricted roles and permissions, that's something to also consider, not just for client access, but for your own employees. You don't want to give them more than they absolutely need to do their jobs and complete the functions and operations necessary for collections.
And you mentioned a good piece, Matt, as well, because there's software companies out there that have collection software. And I'm not going to name names because I know most of the big ones out there, but there's been a couple, and they'll tell you up front, if you look at your contract, that they actually put, if they're hosting your collection system, they may be hosting it on a server with other companies. And that not only will that make a difference in how you can access your data, because they'll restrict your rights on if you can use SQL and how you can get your information out of the system. But at the same time, what if I'm compromised? Does some other agency working on the same server have a super hacker? How are those kept apart? If it's VPN machines on one server, then they can keep them completely separated to where there's no access between the two. If it's the same host software and they're keeping you in different bundles, whether it's be called a namespace or different block of data, then you want them to explain and be able to demonstrate how that those data can't, that they can't be compromised, that that another associated client of theirs can't get to your data, what they've done to restrict that type of access.
Excellent. Let's move on. And there are a bunch of great questions coming in. So if you do have a question that you'd like to ask the panel, I would recommend you open up the Zoom webinar control panel and type it in now. We've got a couple more discussion topics I'd like to get to, but we've got some good questions already in the queue that I'm excited to get to in a little bit. Let's move on and let's talk about, I'm curious how deeply or how much regulators or examiners care or are looking at the safety and security policies and procedures related to web-based software. Is this something that you're seeing more and more of in the ARM industry, or are the regulators and examiners not necessarily caring that much? I'm curious and whether or not they treat it any differently than hosted software. And Matt being the only representative directly from an agency, maybe you can weigh in first this time.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We were recently audited by the OFR, that's the Office of Financial Regulation here in Florida, and they are regularly going around and auditing agencies, and they're trying to do it once every 4 or once every 5 years. And they reviewed all of our entire policies and procedures and requested data and recordings, and specifically looked at not only how we secure our data and our system, but our document retention and destruction policies and procedures. It included how we've even vetted our own shredding company and the logs related to shredding. Now, I know that's not cloud-based, but the point of the matter is they are looking into this and they want to make sure you're securing the data. And if you have servers and stuff in there, they're going to make sure, just like a skip tracing company would, and they, when they vet you for skip tracing, they're going to make sure you're a real facility, that the server is behind locked doors, that you're restricting access, that you have, for instance, a visitor's policy, they're escorted around anywhere where there's PHI, so that a person could not gain access to your unit and get that information. And the same thing applies to your internet. You know, if you allow guests to have Wi-Fi access, you're going to have to lock that down. You guys might have talked about that earlier, so I do apologize. But the one particular thing they liked is the fact that we locked up cell phones, or we actually have cell phone cubbies that the phones have to go in. They can't go out on the collection floor. So, you know, these days a phone device is, a phone itself is just as strong as the NASA computers were that sent our first spaceships up. So a lot of data and a lot of protection that's needed there.
Excellent. Thank you. Does anybody else want to take a crack at what they're seeing or hearing in terms of what the regulators are looking at as it pertains to questions or concerns about web-based software?
So this is Kevin, and I can't really speak directly to what regulators in are looking at directly, but what I can say is that in general, adoption of cloud technologies has reignited the safety and compliance story and security. And how do we do all these things? And we are seeing various, the auditing firms, the quality assurance teams, they're definitely taking a deeper look. I think there's been a lot of spotlight cast on cloud security in general. I would say that generally speaking, we welcome this. This is a good thing. We want to have the conversation. We want it to be open. We want people talking about this because there'll be just inherently more awareness. And we do see that. And we see as more and more people move to the cloud, this is a hot topic. People are talking about it. People are getting assessed. Their auditing firms are coming in. They're asking a lot of hard questions. Sometimes they don't have all the answers when first go. But even that is valuable. It really gives them some directional value in, we have to go and get these answers. We have to do better. So this is, I think the advent of cloud has really reignited the topic. I think when we all felt secure in our data centers, the topic wasn't coming up quite as much.
Thanks, Kevin. Let's move on and maybe look a little bit from the client side and Jeremy, I wanted to give you the chance to weigh in first. Are you, you know, the conversation that you're having with the collection agencies, can you talk maybe a little bit about the conversations they're having with their clients, be it creditors or healthcare providers, in terms of the use of web-based software and whether that's something that's a concern or not, and if it is, what's being done to sort of mitigate those concerns?
Sure. When I'm dealing with agencies out there, and actually all in, I deal with agencies, attorneys' offices, creditors, but I'll pick on agencies in particular since that's what was brought up. What I find a lot of the questions coming in, and where a lot of their questions are coming in, not just from regulators, but from, like you said, from their clients, is they want to know what you know and the depth of what you know about what's going on, the method as much as the answer. Or sometimes in more cases, the method as opposed to the answer. So in cases of web-based software, I don't think that creditors or the government officials are picking on it specifically, but they're incorporating it just as if it was in your office. So today they're looking at it as you're as responsible as if you're housing the data inside your office. No less than what you're required to do in your office. And in your office, it's a lot is that they're asking for these days. If you've got any type of government or, say, student loan contracts, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you're dealing with government, a lot of times it comes across FSMA security standards. If you're dealing with hospital systems, as HIPAA was mentioned before, and actually if you get into the credit card and retail space, they were probably working these angles long before HIPAA came up with healthcare. But what I find they're asking is, who's got access? What type of security methods are you using? If you deal with the CFPB at all, or if I've ever had to deal with them, they're going to be looking for what type of information standard protocol or documentation compliance protocol you're using in your office. And if you're not following some sort of standard, they're going to beat you up on that because they're going to look for key point indicators to them as far as what you're using, what you're looking for, and how you're scoping and assessing risk to your different pieces. And I think one thing that sometimes comes up on the back end that I will point out is, and this comes up with not only web-based applications and web-based software, but it also comes up even if you're housing the software in your office and you've got a software company that's multinational. But I've seen one thing that can be a hot topic at times is they go and they look at some of your core software, and if it's in the web, they'll say, okay, who's got access? Okay. And if you can't answer that, then you have to run over to your vendor and say, okay, who on your site has access? Where's the locations? Where's the house? And where's your people that have access to it? And one thing I noticed about 5 years ago was there was some people using outsourced talent. I'll say talent, but they were using European and then they were using Indian. And when you bring up, especially if it has to do with federal data, that's a very nasty topic. So if you have to think about who's going to be your clientele, if they're going to be any type of federal data on there, you need to know anybody that's going to have potential access to your data, even if they're just a programmer, a developer on the software side for the company that's housing any part of that information or touching that information, that it's a hot topic if there's developers or anybody that has access to that data. Now, such as a web software solution, they could have developers that don't have access to the actual place where the data is stored, only to the development part, which can be housed off in a different area, or can be completely separated or barred from the actual operating software. But one thing to keep an eye out for is if they're using, say, India or any type of outsourced solutions or South America, wherever it might be, that has access or has the capability to gain access to that data, because there's a big concern that external countries having access. And I think what's kind of spoofed that up a little bit is with all the news media talking about North Korea and their capabilities to intercept Russia and their capabilities to intercept. So everybody's asking the question, who's got access out there? Because it's often easy for companies to with their firewalls to section off IP addresses, known IP addresses that go to other countries, so that way they can try to avoid a lot of the hacking that's going on out there directly. Even though they can spoof IP addresses, at least they can end direct hacking from countries that they're not doing business with. So that's something to keep in mind is who's got access, who the company says has access to it, and some type of guarantee in place that if they decide to use some type of outsourced contracting, that they have to notify in advance before that's allowed if they're going to have access to your data.
Hey, it's Keith. Real quick comment on that also as it relates to NIST controls specifically, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So NIST is the framework and the platform. Really is a lot of HIPAA and PCI are based on, and then works hand in hand with ISO 27001. Out of 10 critical security controls, if you have a NIST-based assessment that are specific to applications, 7 of those aren't really applicable in cases where your applications are outsourced to another group. So they are applicable only to in-house developed applications. So, you know, just one more point there that you are transferring some risks and, you know, getting to mark NA on some of those NIST controls if you're, you know, using a web-based software versus something you developed in-house.
And this is Jeremy. If you do have to come across NIST controls, NIST 800-53, government controls, if you need to framework your environment to meet that, or you think you're going to be having clients that are on a NIST, that are looking at the NIST framework, the government framework, that's basically a copy off of ISO 27001, 27002. If you go look on the government site, they give you a walk across. And so if I was an agency that was going to be doing business or thought I'd be doing business with a government section or somebody that's holding government data, if it was me, I would probably go look at getting an ISO 27001 certification so that that way I'd be right in line with NIST 800-53.
Keith, I had a question for you. Is there such a thing as, you know, a company using too much web-based software?
It's a good question. I really think it depends on what your requirements are as a company. Every company is different, has different requirements, different ways that they work, and best practices they've established to figure out, you know, what their operations need to look like. I think it's important that you select a software that will work with you and adapt to your operating model. You know, certainly having led so many medical record systems conversions, you know, one of the issues we saw is that many times people will select a very rigid web-based app that they then have to change all of their operations to work the way that the software works. And it's not good for anyone. So make sure that, you know, it's a robust and flexible web app. But, you know, it really, really depends on what your needs are. As the maturity of these web-based apps increases, then more and more it makes less sense to have in-house software or to build your own software or to build out your infrastructure for software, unless you just want to build an IT company within your ARM company. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. You know, our dialer, our collection software, and our phone system is entirely cloud-based. So one of the downfalls is if the internet goes down, which, you know, Frontier and some of these others notoriously go down all the time, we're totally down. So I think that's a question you got to ask, that, you know, what part of the country are you in and how reliable is your internet connectivity there? And depending on that, you might want to even consider a backup plan. Like we're on Fios, but one of the backups could be, you know, having a cable access to the net through a cable modem that you could just flip a switch and it goes from Fios to cable if the internet were down. But the plus side is, you know, we're a hurricane prone Florida. So if our call center were to be demolished, we could be literally up and running anywhere where we have computers and internet connection. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, factoring in those concerns.
And this is Jeremy. Matt, you make a good point on that. And there's another thing that comes up with that as well, as you were talking about, most of everything you have runs off internet. One thing agencies have to be aware of is pipelines. And pipelines are, you know, as far as pipeline, the amount of data that you can get through your office today is very, it's not as expensive as it used to be. It's a lot more cost effective. But the one thing you need to keep in mind is, as far as your internet connectivity, what your pipeline is. Because you may be out there buying what, let's say AT&T says, we've got fiber now and it's a gig pipeline. You'll find that you really don't have a whole gig of data. And then what the guarantee is, because most times when you talk to those companies, as far as pipelines, they have a burst rate and then they have an expected rate. And then you can buy the business, and hopefully you're buying the business package. The business package, a lot of them can give you a guaranteed rate of volume, so that way that you have the download speeds and you have the download volume to be able to handle all of the web connectivity that you're going to be doing today. Because we're talking about a hosted system. If you're hosting files and data and all that's transferring and phone calls, the phone calls have got to be stable and they require so much, and you got to know the compression level of the packages, because compression level is going to tell you how much bandwidth per user is going to be required. You need to make sure you're keeping up with that. Matt's point of having a backup solution is I think very important to that. If you're going to be mostly web hosted on those type of solutions, what you can fail over to. But watch that pipeline, and we also be cautious of upload, because if you're doing a lot of data into or up to the cloud, that can make a large difference, because they're going to guarantee, if they're going to guarantee a 100 meg pipeline, and a lot of these internet connection systems, they may have 100 down, but they're only 5 up or 10 up or 15 up. Make sure that you're not going to be required that you need 50 up, because once you hit that wall, now you're going to have to do some bending and stretching to be able to manage that. It's not something you can necessarily do overnight. I knew one company, they had it on 20 people, and they hit, they didn't even make it to the 20 extra people they're hiring on. They got 5 deep and found out that they'd hit the maximum capacity of their, not only their intranet that they're bringing, their internet that they're bringing in, but their firewall had to be upgraded. It was an older firewall. It couldn't handle the pipeline beyond that. So there can be some growing pains in there that you have to be aware of as well.
That's a good point. And also know that this is where application level QoS comes in, to where you got to get, if you're using a web-based app, you need to get serious about content filtering and really managing that bandwidth. That means, you know, let's put content filtering rules to block Netflix. Because if someone jumps on Netflix, takes all your bandwidth, or is doing a major download, then it's going to crush your web apps. You know, let's categorize and look at things like social media and YouTube and say, look, we're going to limit and throttle back that bandwidth at a very low level. One, because it's not for business use. Maybe we'll open up a little bit more bandwidth for the marketing department. One of the things we do for our clients is just really mapping out what that usage is and what business critical apps are, and make sure that they're at the top of the priority stack. So they're using all your bandwidth, and then you're limiting, unneeded and unnecessary apps so they don't interfere with your critical apps.
Before we get to the questions, and we're almost out of time, I have one last question I wanted to ask. And you know, time-wise, you know, collection agency terminals weren't connected to the internet. You know, they were all sort of, just connected to whatever server in the office they needed to be connected to. But clearly that's not the case anymore. So maybe we can talk a little bit about how that necessity of internet access has changed infrastructure security. Maybe talk about how any computer on a network that is a threat today, because it's impossible to do business without access to the internet. Anybody want to tackle that one?
Well, you're talking about just privacy policies in general when using, you know, your web-based software and access to computers in the center?
Well, I think more along the lines of, you know, these days, you know, there were, you know, there was a time when, you know, collection, you know, a collection agency terminal didn't need to be connected to the internet. But I think that those days are very much in the past, if not at least in the recent past. So I think, you know, it's really changed how collection agencies specifically need to sort of address their infrastructure security, because there are so many more computers now that are, you know, piped into the, you know, to what's going on outside the four walls of the agency. And I think that
right.
created a series of other concerns or issues that need to be addressed.
Yeah, I think going back, you know, to the days of green screens and lockdown systems where the server was in your center and you didn't give any internet access or anything to employees, you know, it was easier to control back then. But now it's almost a necessity. You have to adapt to that because the consumer preference is to transact business through email and through SMS and all these other things. So, you know, as far as your employees, while you can't control a rogue employee, you can protect yourself with good policies and procedures and just best practices to, you know, control the possibility of an event happening that would be not in your favor. And then that those good policies and procedures would also give you a bona fide error defense as long as you're adhering to them and practicing and then auditing and following up. But I just see you have to change with the times, and it's just like turning a battleship, you know, a collection agency and the way we've been doing things for 15 or 20 years, it's really hard to change. Change in general is hard, but just like you can have a court case come out in two areas of the country that are completely opposite rulings, you have to be able to change. I remember back when the lawsuit was filed on the agency that put the account number in the letter window in near the address, and they were sued because of disclosure. It was supposedly disclosing things. So, you know, you have to make an immediate call into your mail vendor and make that change on your letters, and you've got to be able to do that very quickly. I just think it's.
Go ahead.
I was just going to
move on to some of the questions now from the audience, because we're at 2 o'clock now, and I'd like to try and get through some of these as quick as we can, because some of them I think are pretty good. How are companies that run cloud-based applications getting around on-site physical audit requirements for certain certifications and creditor audits when the application is hosted with companies like Amazon, Google, and/or Microsoft?
So I could probably speak to that a little bit for you. As you can imagine, if your data center is in a public cloud like Amazon, none of us are ever going to be invited to an Amazon data center. And I think for the most part, that, you know, the auditing agencies understand how this works. Really what it comes down to is making sure that your provider, whether it's Amazon or anyone else, has the latest attestations available. And those attestations would then be shared. One thing to note is they're always done under NDA. And you can then share those back with your auditors. And generally speaking, this is accepted. It's very rare that we get pushback or come back on that in particular. But it is important that we're always sharing the latest attestations. Attestations are only as good as the last audit. And these things are periodic, so we need to make sure we have the latest ones.
And this is Jeremy. To add to that, is the way you handle that today is contractually. It's in your contracts, and you run it down the line. That's how hospitals have to handle it with collection agencies. It's an extension of your service. So if you've got a web provider out there, a web app provider out there, and they're putting it on Amazon or whatever the preface may be, they need to have contractual agreements with Amazon or the co-location it's at that says we're going to meet these standards. They need to have that in their contract back to you, because your clients, especially if it's like a hospital system, they have to put those in, that you and your subcontractors have to have that level of security. And there should be, as they were saying, auditors all the way. So every level should have some type of audit functionality. They're either being audited by you, or they have a third party auditing them or certifying them that they are on a regular basis being audited and can prove that they've been audited to a certain standard and what that standard is and what those rules are.
Excellent. I've got time. I think we'll take time for one more question. In public clouds such as AWS, what new skills are needed to adapt services?
Again, I think I could probably speak a little bit to this. There are going to be a lot of new things that engineers and architects are going to have to learn. But there's also a lot of fundamental stuff that they carry through their careers that still translates, particularly in let's say an Amazon world, making sure you fully understand the service, making sure you fully understand how to secure those services, making sure that you understand how to build highly available services. We talked a little bit about business continuity a little bit earlier, and if we build a service on a single virtual machine and that hypervisor fails, we'll lose service. So making sure we know how to build for highly available services, making sure that we're fault tolerant, that things are recoverable. A lot of automation. To make the cloud work really well for you, you have to double down on the automation. You have to make your architecture self-healing. In a physical data center, there was always automation to some extent, and I think the public cloud pushes you to embrace automation at a much deeper level. Besides for the specific stuff to the platform you're working on, really just doubling down on automation, again doubling down on security awareness and security training. And then the other thing that we didn't talk a lot about, but also understanding that the cloud is a consumption-based utility, so we pay for everything we use. If we switch it off, we stop. So we also need to make sure that we understand how to operate cost-efficiently in an environment like that.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Well, we've gone past the hour that I promised the speakers we'd limit this to, and I appreciate them all sticking around for a few extra minutes. Before I let everybody go, I want to thank Jeremy, Matt, Kevin, and Keith for their insights and their time today. This webinar would not have been possible without their participation. I also wanted to thank InterPros one more time for sponsoring today's webinar, bringing this great information to the ARM industry. Please go to www.interpros.com to learn more about the company, or call 844-224-1135 for more information. Thanks to everybody who registered and participated today. Thanks to everybody who asked questions and engaged with us. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event will be posted up on the site in the next day or so. And I hope everybody enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.